Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Dave Rosenberg, Peter Buchvar, and Ira Harris. Dave founded his own firm, Rosenberg Research, after being chief economist and strategist at Gluck & Scheff. The firm offers extensive research and information services with a trial service that we'll post up a link to as well. He served as chief economist for Merrill Lynch and one of the 12 smartest people on Wall Street by Business Insider. Peter is chief investment officer for the Bleakley Financial Group and Advisory at Bleakley. He has a newsletter product called the Book Report, BOOKREPORT.com. It offers great macroeconomic insight and perspective with lots of updates on economic indicators. And Ira is independent trader, hedge fund manager, global macro consultant trading foreign currencies, equities, bonds, commodities for over 40 years. He was also CME director from 1997 to 2003 and a stint most recently. Welcome, gentlemen.
Great to be on.
Great. I thought we'd begin with a discussion at the high level view, your macro view on the economy and the financial markets. Maybe we can start with Dave.
Well, sure. And I want to say thanks again for inviting me on. It's been a long time. And I was just thinking that if I was the 12th smartest person, then I think that there's two on the call that are way ahead of me, but I'll take the 12 anyways. Let's just say that, I was saying that when the Fed first started tightening in March, that in the historical record, 85% of the time, the economy slips into recession. And 15% of the time, we get a soft landing. And so back in March, I never said that we couldn't have a soft landing. I just said I wouldn't make a base case out of it. And then the yield curve starts to invert in the spring. And I say, well, notwithstanding the fact that, Jay Powell manufactured his own favorite yield curve, the 2s-10s curve, despite its warts and its pimples and its scars, have a terrific track record in predicting a recession, of course, with variable lags. But without getting into the timing, yield curve inverts is the bond market's way of screaming uncle. And I said at that point, we have more than a 90% chance of a recession. I never said it was 100 at that point. I said, we've gone from 85 to 90. And then we got the Conference Board's leading economic indicators, which is running negative over the past 7 months. Past 7 months, the Conference Board's leading economic indicator, which is really the gold standard for leading indicators. I don't think you need economists around. You just have to follow the Conference Board's LEI. And it's been around since 1959. And when you're down this much in a seven-month period, we've been in recession within the next 3 to 6 months, 100% of the time. So let's just say that the prosecution should rest. The recession is staring us in the face. Whether or not it was a recession in the first half of the year is a nice academic debate. It's in the rearview mirror. What is going to happen in the next year is we're going to have a recession. We can debate whether it's going to be mild or deep, but we're going to have a recession. It may already be starting, even though it's not in the labor market just yet. Employment is always the last man standing when you're heading from expansion to recession. And I would say that, therefore, in the coming year, I'm bullish on treasuries. Painful trade, I get that, but that's been more because of the inflation shocks, which I think are now subsiding, and the Fed. And although we're not at the end of the tightening cycle, I think we're getting pretty darn close to it. And so the only point I'll make is that as far as the stock market's concerned, against the backdrop of a recession, in recessionary bear markets, the S&P 500 bottoms 70% of the way into the recession. and it bottoms 30% of the way ahead of the recovery. Well, this recession is just getting going, or it's staring us in the face. So to be talking about the stock market putting in a real fundamental low as opposed to a tradable low is, to me, utterly ridiculous. And there is no bottom in a fundamental recession bear market ever without bond yields going down first. Bond yields have to go down to widen out the equity risk premium to more, shall we say, comfortable levels that would make you want to start to go long stocks for the next cycle. I think that'll be the story towards the end of next year. It's still early. But before you turn bullish on stocks, you have to turn bullish on treasuries first. And I think there'll be some serious tailwinds for treasuries next year after the past couple of years of horrible negative returns. I think we're going to have the Fed cutting rates probably in the second half of the year, certainly will not be immediate. Inflation is not going to be sticky. Inflation is going to come down significantly, and the economy is going into a recession. And if you're going to turn bullish on equities, as I say, you're going to bullish on equities, the treasury market needs to help you out first. That's the chicken that has to come before the egg. And I'll leave it there.
Mm-hmm. Great. Interesting with the historical perspective view. And your thoughts, Peter, on the macro view?
Well, I'm honored to be following David. We have a lot of similar thoughts. When you look at the first three quarters of 2022, and you look at the GDP number that was just printed on a real basis relative to Q4 2019, the economy is basically flatlined this year. But if you look under the hood, housing's in a recession. We've seen that the all six of the regional manufacturing surveys were all below zero. And the only reason why the ISM manufacturing number was above was because it's just how they calculate it. And they don't include a lot of small and medium-sized businesses. The S&P Global Services PMI is below 50 for four straight months. If you're a lower income consumer, you're in your own personal recession. If you're doing business in Europe, you're probably in a recession. If you're doing business with the Chinese, you're probably in a recession. So and whether it's technically or not, the trajectory of economic growth is down and will continue to weaken. And just look at the impact that the sharp rise in interest rates has on the economy. It has the obvious impacts on the interest rate sensitive parts like housing and autos. But people have to understand that at least on the U.S. side, a lot of economic growth is done with small, medium-sized businesses. And a lot of these small, medium-sized businesses probably have borrowed money to run their business. And they probably borrowed from their local bank, or if they were lucky enough to get a loan from the private credit space, chances are it's floating rate. And they're seeing a sharp rise in their interest expense. If you're in the real estate market that has a loan coming due this year or next year, well, that loan is going to reprice at probably twice the rate or even more that you were paying before. So not only do we have the slowdown that's going on currently, but you can even map out this deterioration as we go deeper into 2023. And not just having the rate rises, but that them staying there, and that we're having to become accustomed to life with a structurally higher cost of capital. I say structurally just because it could stay at these levels. And even if the Fed starts cutting, they're not cutting back to zero. Even if they cut, let's just say they take the Fed funds rate to 4.75, and they cut it back down to 3.5 to 4, that's still a structurally higher cost of capital than the economy is used to. I agree with David, not to the same extent, but that inflation is rolling over, particularly on the good side. And that's where a lot of the inflation surprise took place, was on the good side. The 20 years leading into COVID, goods inflation averaged zero. The only reason why we had 1% to 2% inflation in the aggregate was because we had near 3% services inflation. So the good side is going to see a pretty rapid decline in the rate of gains. I think the question in the aggregate is what happens with services inflation. And that, of course, will happen on a lag basis with rents. But medical care costs is pretty persistent regardless of what the Fed does, and we'll see where it shakes out. So we're going to get the drop in inflation, and then it won't be until 2024, 2025 to see where that inflation rate settles out, in the sense of, do we just go back to pre-COVID of 1 to 2, or is there something that's different this time and we're going to settle out maybe a 3 to 4 after the initial decline in 2023. I think for markets, it's still going to remain extraordinarily challenging, because not only do you have an economic recession, we're going to have an earnings recession. And a key part of measuring the degree of that earnings recession, it's easy to say, okay, the top line is going to moderate in a recession, particularly if inflation slows, revenue growth is going to slow too, because for many companies, inflation is the only thing that's driving revenue growth, particularly for the consumer products companies, where all their revenue growth is inflation. I think the profit margin story is underappreciated. And a part of that is because labor costs are running double the pace in the 20 years leading into COVID. And while it's not high on an absolute basis, and it's still below the rate of inflation, it's higher than what we're used to. I mean, the main drivers of profit margin expansion over the last many years was lowered interest expense, modest labor costs. And those two have reversed, obviously, pretty sharply here. So that's sort of a double whammy with earnings, is slowing revenue in addition to compression in profit margins. So I think the stock market is still going to be very challenged, because also you throw in compressing multiples. And to me, there are three stages of a bear market. It's the first stage is you take out a lot of the froth. You re-rate a lot of the overvalued parts of the market. The second phase is growth slows and you cut earnings estimates. And I feel like we're just really beginning the second phase. And the third phase is everyone just throws in the towel and no one wants to own a stock again. And we're clearly far away from that. And in fixed income, I'm much more confident in buying the short end of the yield curve. I can make David's argument for sure that the long end is a buy, and that rates on the 10-year, let's just say, going to go sharply lower. But I can also make an argument that has nothing to do with the pace of growth and inflation, is that central banks sort of lose control of their bond markets, that the Bank of Japan, whether it's before Kuroda leaves or after, and he decides to get rid of yield curve control or widens the band, you know, that could be very disruptive to the world's bond markets. How the ECB manages their bond market as they get deeper into raising rates and possibly do QT in the first quarter. What happens if they lose control of the Italian bond yields? And what does that mean for global bonds? And what in the treasury market with QT and if the Japanese need to start selling more US treasuries and others do, and the banks are buying less, and what happens if there's a gilt-like accident in the treasury market? I'm not saying it's going to happen, but there's the possibility. You know, what does that mean for the 10-year? So I can also make the argument that the 10-year yield goes to 5%. Again, not for economic reasons, but because of this unwinding of this global sovereign bond bubble that still has a way to play out. So I'm just less confident. And that's an I don't know. I'm bringing out risks. I don't know how that plays out. But I'm just trying to make the point that I'm just less confident on where the 10-year yield goes, and much more confident that we've basically reached peak hawkishness. And the 2-year yield here between 4.5 to 4.75, we've obviously closed at the upper end of that range today, is pretty compelling. So I'll stop there.
Very interesting. Any idea or forecast on the time frame for your phase 2 and phase 3? Perspective on the bear market?
Well, we're just, you know, we're in phase 2 right now, but probably on the more the beginning side of that. Phase 2 will probably more play out in 2023, and maybe the back half of 2023. If the markets do fall notably, then you'll get the people throwing in the towel.
Interesting. And your thoughts? I run the Macro View, and also,
well, I agree with a lot of what's been said, of course, and I think David's point is, especially when we look at the 210, the timeline as to when all this plays out, I don't know. I've looked at this for 40 years, and I've always maintained the timeline runs a pretty wide gamut. And we, you know, and if you use the Volcker timeline, that's a different thing, because we got much more aggressive than we're going to get now. Now, I think there's going to be a few stocks to own, especially in things that companies that produce agricultural goods, mining goods, because I agree with David and Peter, I think we will both agree with this. Jerome Powell thinks he's going to get to real yields on the short end, like we saw in 2018, but we saw how fast he turned tail when that was taking place. I don't think we're going to see real yields on the short end. And without seeing real positive yields on the short end, I like owning things that, you know, as Dennis Gartman would always say, that if you drop on your feet, on your foot, it would hurt. So I would look for things like that, because I think, first of all, their earnings are pretty good. And these companies, unbelievably, are actually paying down a lot of debt. I'm talking about companies like Glencore and Bungie and Archer. These companies are actually doing some positive things. So I'm looking for things like that. Other things I'm not looking for at all. But I don't think, and I think this is a very important thing, because Powell keeps coming back to it, and he said it again yesterday, that the real yield on Fed funds is going to go positive. Well, I'm going to challenge that, because I don't think we're going to get anywhere near positive. And yesterday he brought out that, well, what did he say? The long view on inflation expectations. And what are they? And as far as I know, what they use to measure that is the tips, basically, to find out what the real, but when you realize how much of the tips market the Fed owns, that they're basically manipulating it, whether they'll admit it or not. So there's too many things that are out there, I think, but I have not been in David's camp for a while, but I am there now, because I think that the world is staring down that gun right now, especially with an overly strong dollar, which is, of course, due to the Fed policy. The rest of the world is no great shakes, and Europe is looking worse each and every day. So the dollar goes higher. It's going higher in places where it's causing a lot of difficulty and travail. And the only way that, to me, that the dollar helps the U.S. is if the rest of the world absolutely goes into not just a recession, a severe recession, and everybody starts dumping all kinds of goods all over the world. But as Peter points out, we don't have really that. Goods inflation has already started to decline. And Peter writes about that regularly with the Cass freight index. We're seeing that. So I think all there is just, again, nobody can really time it. We think we have, but if, and I'm not saying that Powell even has to pivot. You know, I think that gets overplayed. If he were to pause, let quantitative tightening go further, but that the real, the real yield on funds never goes positive. In fact, stays very negative. You know, the beloved Taylor rule. I think we'll see certain asset classes really perform better.
Great. And your thoughts, Dave, on the U.S. yield curve, the Federal Reserve policy and statement yesterday, this week, and where the U.S. dollar is going. Do you still see it as strengthening?
Well, I think near term, the U.S. dollar is going to continue to strengthen because there's no doubt that the Fed is still the most hawkish central bank, and not just going 75 basis points, but also sounding much more hawkish than, say, the ECB has, or the Bank of England, the RBA, the Bank of Canada. They're still barking a lot louder. So currencies primarily are driven by interest rate differentials. And I think that until the Fed stops tightening or certainly signals that direction, the U.S. dollar, the upper trajectory is going to remain intact. So I'd say that on a three-month view, I think you've got to be bullish on the U.S. dollar. I mentioned before about the yield curve, the Fed tightening this aggressively into an inverted yield curve, the Fed tightening into monetary contraction. The money supply numbers are contracting, M1 and M2. People like to talk about the level of the money supply, but it's never about the levels of anything. It's about the change. For investors, levels are nothing. It's all about the rate of change, and change is always at the margin. And the money supply numbers are contracting. We have fiscal restraint, a booming dollar, an economy flat in its back. and inverted yield curve, and the Fed is tightening policy. And that is exactly the scenario that we had in our hands under Volcker in the early 80s. And we have a central banker who is so desperate to no longer be compared to Arthur Burns that he brings up comparisons to Paul Volcker whenever he can. So that's what's important. He is comparing himself to Paul Volcker. He is not going to have the second term of his tenure be a legacy that people will compare to Arthur Burns. He wants to be compared to Paul Volcker, who inherited a much bigger and more complicated inflationary mess than Powell did. But nonetheless, he compares himself to Powell. Powell engineered double dip recessions over a three-year period, a bear market in equities over a three-year period, and everybody wants to know where the Fed put is. Well, we have a central banker that's comparing himself to Paul Volcker, and the Volcker put in August of 1982 for the uninitiated was 8. And then we built from the ashes a 20-year uninterrupted economic expansion and bull market, and I think maybe we'll get there again. But you're asking me about Powell. Look, these guys at the Fed, they know they're chasing lagging indicators. They know what's happening with the economy. They know that the construct of the CPI is basically meaningless. It's not a real-time indicator. The CPI is, as Alan Greenspan called it in 1996 in one of the FOMC transcripts, a flawed statistic for the reasons Peter Buchvar mentioned, because 30% of it is rents, and those rents move with lags because of the leases that were signed previously. But that is in the rearview mirror. Inflation is falling in real time. The bottleneck pressures and the poster child for bottleneck pressures, supply chain pressures, is the ISM, Vendor Delivery Delay Index. And that's down to levels that we saw before COVID. Prices paid down to May 2020 levels. If you're looking at inflation in real time, it's coming down significantly, and services are always sticky. So typically when you drive the economy into deflation, it's not usually services, unless it's cyclical services, that could certainly happen. Rent, education, health, they don't typically decline in the worst recessions. They're not even worth looking at. What you want to look at is what happens with goods prices, because they're the most cyclical. And so, you know, when I take a look at Powell yesterday, it was a perfect setup. They put in a new sentence on policy lags. They wait to see how the market's going to respond. Like Pavlov's dog, the market goes vertical up. And they realize that they've not expunged the speculative behavior in the equity market. They want to, what does the Fed want to do? They want to get rid of the Fed put. They want to get rid of the concept of the Fed put. And so what Powell's really doing, and he has the whole committee behind him, is he is really repudiating the Greenspan, Bernanke, Yellen doctrine of relying on wealth effects from the stock market on the real economy. He is attempting to break that too tight link between Wall Street and Main Street. That's what he's doing. He is eliminating the Fed put from the financial market vernacular. And that was apparent yesterday, because when they saw the market go vertical up, he lobs the bomb that the Fed is actually thinking of raising rates over and beyond the terminal rate from what they were saying in September, and then leaving it there for longer. And I'm not so sure he would have used that language had he not seen yet again the stock market doesn't get it. They want to tighten financial conditions. They want different levels of residential real estate and equity markets. Whether you like it or not, that's what they want. In their quest for lower consumer inflation, they have to create the conditions for asset deflation. And I don't know why people just don't get it. It's very interesting to me, and it's just call it human behavior. From March 2020 all the way to the December 2021 highs, it was all about don't fight the Fed, don't fight the Fed, don't fight the Fed, don't fight the Fed. And yet they're fighting the Fed. The October rally, you can argue, was a technically based rally, Fibonacci reversals, so on and so forth. The bulls are fighting the Fed. The bears tried to fight the Fed. They got creamed in 2020 and 2021. The bulls are trying to fight the Fed. The Fed is telling you they want a different market than they did before under different conditions. And Kashkari told us that after Jackson Hole. They want the market to go lower. And so when you ask me about Jay Powell, He can talk about the labor market and job openings, which is a useless statistic. He can talk about the CPI. Service sector CPI, by the way, goes in the conference board's index of lagging indicators. If that's your bag, focus on CPI services. It's a lagging indicator. It's driving by looking through the rearview mirror. The Fed knows all that, but people buy into it. You couldn't open up a newspaper today and not read about job openings. Nobody talked about the fact that job hirings, that new hirings, are actually on a downward slope of significance. Nobody talks about that. Nobody talks about the fact that the quit rate has come well off its cycle high, which is a sign that the working class is becoming slightly less emboldened than they were before. No, no, no. It's about job openings, job openings, job. They jawbone about job openings. They jawbone about inflation being sticky. They're trying to drum up reasons why, from the economic side, as to why they got to continue to tighten policy into an inverted yield curve. But I really believe after yesterday's, I mean, that was a pivot, wasn't it? From statement to the lectern. That was a pivot in a half an hour. And that was, to me, a real sign that if you're trading equities from the long side, be really careful.
Very interesting. Your thoughts, Peter, on Dave's view. And also, you mentioned the sovereign debt crisis unfolding. Could we see potentially funds coming from that internationally into U.S. equities, particularly the Dow equities, as a flight to safety?
No. If the sovereign bond market blows up, the stocks are not going to be a flight to safety. The only thing that'll be a flight to safety is cash. So that I don't see. Just a couple of just follow-ups to what Dave is saying, and Powell sort of revealed more of his hands yesterday when he said that, hey, you know what, if I over-tighten, no big deal, because I can just cut thereafter. And it was sort of like, yeah, if I kill the patient, don't worry, I got the tools to resuscitate it. And I think that that's a dangerous thing. And David also made the right point that, and you have to sort of wonder if there was a, let's just say Powell left tomorrow and the new person appointed would not be within the institution. It was an outsider. Would they view the current situation in the same way as Powell? And the reason why I say that is because Powell seems to be obsessed with his legacy and his reputation, and he screwed up, and now he's trying to not be in the wall of shame of central bankers, and he wants to be in the Hall of Fame with Paul Volcker. And is that sort of clouding his decision making here? And I say that because I don't quibble with having positive real interest rates or attempting to it. Because I think having negative real interest rates for a long period of time has been hugely distortive in terms of its impact on economic activity. I think it's the rate of speed at which they are hiking that is the biggest risk. And you know, and I'll just gonna whip out my calculator here just for a moment, because I think it's important to understand what this is doing to the economy, or I should say leverage players. Particularly in real estate, you know, if you bought a multifamily building, call it 2 years ago, all right, and or even if you started construction on one, and you took a construction loan, but knowing that it would eventually have to convert to a conventional loan, or on the other hand, you bought a building, and let's just say you paid $20 million, or if that's your construction cost, or you build an existing building, and you were lucky enough to get a 2.75% mortgage. Well, first of all, let's just say that you put down 30%, you did a loan to value of 70%. So you got a $14 million loan. On that $14 million loan, you're lucky enough to be paying $385,000 in interest expense. But next year, that loan matures, or if you developed, you need to convert that into a new loan. But unfortunately, you got to pay 7% now. So 7% on that $14 million loan is now going to cost you about $1 million of interest expense. So your interest expense is essentially tripled just within a couple of years. And if you modeled out your building at a 4% cap rate, or maybe even 5%, you're going to be handing back the keys to the bank. And just multiply that by many times. And just an example of sort of the shock therapy of how fast rates are going, that many businesses that borrowed and didn't lock in a fixed rate, that it is a shock to that economic system. So I think that is one thing that the Fed is not appreciating. Like, if a company has good earnings, the stock rallies, okay? But after that initial rally, it consolidates that rally for a period of time, because the market then wants to be convinced whether that good quarter is something sustainable. And if it is, well, then the stock can resume a rally, and of course, vice versa. So the Fed is not proceeding over any consolidation. They're just going straight up with the tightening and not really looking around. Now, I understand from his perspective, he wants to front load these hikes, and this meeting was his way of saying, okay, now I'm going to back off. I'm going to slow the pace of rate increases. I'll be more economically sensitive, but that's only after going from 0 to 4 in 9 months, actually less than that. Rates were at 0 in February before the March meeting. So yeah, call it 9 months going from 0 to 4. So the accidents are already beginning to happen, and we're not necessarily hearing about it. And I'm not talking about something that's systemic and we have to worry about the banking system. I'm very worried about actually death by 1,000 cuts, and that everything is going to be a grind. We're going to see a rise in bankruptcies, more companies that can't meet their interest payments, and that this is just going to be a real malaise / slog for a period of time, and that the days of a V bottom in markets or a V bottom on the economy, because the Fed's going to be there to save us, to David's point about the Fed's trying to kill the Fed put, it's not going to happen. Now, I think that the stock market put is going away. I think the bond market put will assert itself if we have a gilt-like situation in U.S. Treasuries.
Okay. Very interesting. Your thoughts, Ira?
Well, I'm going to take a little different tack about yesterday's meeting. And interestingly, when right after that statement came out, I read Peter's work, and Peter highlighted that part of the paragraph, which I think is rightfully called a bow to a Lael Brainard, because I think that I disagree with David here a little bit on this. I think there's a lot of dissension at the Fed, and I think there was a lot of dissension in that meeting yesterday. And I think that's what that paragraph was, so that you could get a unanimous vote with that dissension. But I do agree with David as soon as they brought up the issue about how much markets were rallying. And it wasn't just equity markets, bond markets rallied, the commodity markets, gold took off and rallied $20, close to $20 in the same period. Silver was, everything was rallying. So he walked it back. And he not only walked it back, interestingly, the way he walked it back, and he got very aggressive. And so and I think he's now in the threat. I don't know this. I have no way of knowing. I can only by reading the variables that I look at. He is in the middle of a major political battle, and it's on the horizon, almost the same as Lagarde, because we've watched Lagarde since December. Christine Lagarde has been in a terrible, terrible battle within the EU. She can't start quantitative tightening. She won't start, because that'll lead to the fragmentation. So she buys the hawks off with a little more aggressive interest rates. But what difference does a 2.5% interest overnight rate or deposit rate for the ECB matter when inflation is 8, 9, 10%? And I'll use the 8 number, and I'm being kind. So she's got a problem. He's got the other problem. He's a hawk. Christine Lagarde is a dove in that world, but Jerome Powell is a hawk, and he's got a lot of doves to contend with. And the table was set for the doves, of course, with the letter from Sherrod Brown and Lizzie Warren, of course, the day before the Fed meeting started. And that was by design. And I think that, you know, you've got Lisa Cook, Philip Jefferson, certainly Lael Brainard, and Charlie Evans, who know, you know, so we do, and the dissension must be good. Now everybody says, well, wait for the minutes. The minutes get sanitized, from what I understand, between the chairman and the recording secretary of the Fed, or the whatever the official title is, and they sanitize those meetings. So we'll never really know. And now I'm going to stop talking about Volcker and Jerome Powell, because I know Jerome, I think David, 100%, that's what his legacy wants to be. But I'm going to tell you what, I'm going to embarrass, because I'm not a Powell fan. Once he pivoted in 2018 and he ran cold, once again, Fed funds got to a real 90 basis point yield, according to Julian Bridgen, I think that's absolutely right. Powell is looking for his inner, now, David, when I say this, don't get, his inner Andrew Mellon.
Okay.
Liquidate. Liquidate the real estate holders, liquidate the banks, liquidate. Because that's where he's searching for. Because he just, and he told us this. This is not a surprise. I know Peter and I talked about this, I think back in June or July, when Powell said, look it, we can't do anything about supply. The Fed has no tools at all to deal with the supply bottlenecks. All we can do is create demand destruction, which will lead wealth destruction. We create wealth destruction, which leads to demand destruction. That's all we have, and that's all we're seeing. And that's where we're at. And to me, the dissension must have been so great, because not only do we get that from Powell, but then he goes so far to say, I control the messages, and that's my job. And that was, to me, finding, not only did he find his inner Andrew Mellon, he actually found his inner Al Haig.
Okay. And just a final question for today, given all these risks and trends, where do you see the investment opportunities, investment and trading opportunities? Dave?
Right. Well, look, let me just, I got to respond to one thing about what Ira said, which is that people think that the Fed cannot influence the aggregate supply curve. It could only influence the demand curve when it comes to inflation. But that's not 100% true. I think that there's different layers of what the Fed is doing that they don't tell us openly about. But I think that not only was it the comparisons to Arthur Burns that ruffled Powell's feathers, but it was also when the one thing that didn't happen that should have happened that caught the Fed by surprise, and that was the fact that the participation rate, labor force participation rate, wasn't going up like the Fed had thought. That's what took us down to a 3.5% unemployment rate, was the lack of traction and the participation rate. And this happened even after the worst of COVID was behind us. And that was because of two demographics, the youth and men over the age of 50. And the participation rates didn't gain any traction because these groups thought that they could just get rich in the equity market, the young people with the Reddit accounts, Robinhood accounts, you know, playing AMC up the wazoo, you know, making a small fortune, they never have to go back to work because they're going to make a fortune on the equity market. Think about that. Think of, like, before COVID, did we hear about Robinhood or Reddit accounts? Did we, all that liquidity swashing around the Fed? You see, what happened was that the Fed, 2020, 2021, the Fed has your back, FOMO, TINA, and then people over the age of 50 were thinking about their retirement and realizing I can retire 10 or 15 years earlier because look what the Fed is doing to my 401ks. So when you're put yourself in Powell's shoes and you're hearing about the great retirement, you're trying to get inflation down and people are not going back to work because of the equity market and because of the residential real estate market. People were feeling wealthier artificially, and that was influencing the decision not to come back to the labor market. So let's not pretend that we didn't have all last year, every day and every week, reports on the great retirement theme. And then think about what that meant for the Fed. So this is actually also part of his strategy, which is through interest rates and through the negative wealth effect I am forcing you back into the labor market. That's why they're forecasting. They have the temerity to forecast the 4.4% unemployment rate, which people think, oh, that's still low. I said before, it's change. We're going to be up a percentage point based on their forecast. I think we're going to 6%. And it's not because we're going to have tremendous job loss. It's that people are going to come in and compete for those jobs. And that's why today's job openings are meaningless. Tomorrow's job openings, that's going to look a lot different. More competition for jobs means wage rates recede. That's going to pave the way for inflation. By the way, to Peter Buchvar's view on service sector inflation, it's very, very labor sensitive. Wages are going to decelerate very rapidly. Because what this Fed-led bear market in assets is going to do is cause people to have to go back and look for a job. And there won't be as many jobs in a recession as they were last year. So that's something to consider. In terms of the investment landscape, I would say this. You know, it's what Warren Buffett famously said, that the one thing that we learn from history is that people don't learn from history. There is not a snowball's chance in hell that the stock market is going to put in a fundamental recessionary bottom in advance of a rally in treasuries. You need to have the rally in treasuries to reestablish an acceptable equity risk premium that will pave the way for the next bull market in equities. And when you look at the history, you'll see that the first asset class that goes into a bear market is historically the first asset class to come out of the bear market. It is classic accounting 101 FIFO, first in, first out. And treasuries were the first asset class to go into the bear market. But more to the point, you have never had a fundamental recession bear market low in treasuries absent an earlier rally yield decline in 10-year and 30-year bond yields. The chicken has to come before the egg. So, Mo, am I going to jump in with both feet right now? No. But will I be buying duration right now with a view that the Fed will be done in 2023? Inflation will be going down significantly. It will not be sticky in 2023 and in a recession. You're building up a perfect storm. I can understand Peter Buchvar's exogenous risks. We have to pay attention to exogenous risks. But I'm not talking about what's on the tail. I'm talking about the base case. Is the first asset, if you want to turn bullish on equities, and who doesn't? Even I do, by the way. Treasuries have to rally first. And then we can talk about the bottom in the equity market, hopefully in the second half of next year, only after treasury yields go down. And they have to go down 150 to 200 basis points to reestablish the equity risk premium that would be necessary to start diving back into the stock market. And that's my investment thesis for 2023.
Interesting. Great. And your thoughts, Peter, for the investment landscape?
So I think one of the interesting things about October in that very short rally in the market was that it was predominantly led by value stocks. The S&P value index was up about almost 12%, while the S&P growth side was up about 4 and change. And that's because of big cap tech and tech generally. Valuations continue to fall and earnings continue to get cut. So I do think that this value side of the investment landscape is going to be a much more attractive place to be relative to what worked over the last 5 to 10 years. And that's everything growthy and exciting. And even though that a lot of these stocks have fallen a lot, there's still a lot of more risk to the downside, and that you can actually, in getting to what Ira said, you know, buy things that if they fall on your foot, they hurt, as our friend Dennis has said, and that you can actually buy stocks that are trading with single digit PE multiples. You know, one of the things that, and on the commodity side, which we've been pretty bullish on, particularly energy, when you look what's gone on in Europe with the energy crisis there and the cuts in capacity that have been forced upon industry, whether that's cutting the capacity for fertilizers or aluminum or other chemicals and so on, that there's, when things hopefully maybe improve, China opens up, the Europeans can get through the winter without any accidents, that there's going to be a lot less supply relative to demand in a lot of key things, that if you actually make something that you can hold in your hand, that maybe those businesses and those stocks will be better off in the coming couple of years. Also in the commodity space, I've been very bullish on uranium for years. we now know that nuclear is in this renaissance that I think is just really being noticed. The global demand for uranium is 200 million pounds. We're producing about 130 million pounds. So there's still major supply-demand imbalances that I think will assert itself in much higher uranium prices. I'm still a wounded bull when it comes to precious metals, and still bullish on some Asian markets like Japan and Vietnam and Singapore, and even finding ways to play the eventual Chinese reopening, which I think will happen in March, April when they get through their flu season. I think they'll be much more comfortable with the COVID situation once they get through their flu season.
Great, interesting. And your thoughts, Ira, on the landscape?
Well, I think that's, I agree quite a bit with that. You know, I struggle, and I have great respect for David's view on the bond market. I'm just, when I look at these, the amount of financing it's going to cost to finance the U.S. debt, I mean, the numbers are growing. They're not even, they're growing geometrically. They're not even growing arithmetically on to finance this debt, which is going to cause all kinds of political problems. And I think it's one of the things that, had we have more time to discuss it. So I'm not sure about, I historically, David's 100%. He knows better than anybody that I know on this, but I struggle with it, because we're in such a difficult situation because of the huge amount of debt, the enabling and the facilitation, by the way, of Jerome Powell's Fed. We can argue whether Paul Volcker facilitated that thing when he advised Nixon to go off the gold standard, although I never really got a truly straight answer to that from October 15th of 1971. But I mean, the Fed bears this responsibility because they have elevated debt, not just domestically, globally. And the dollar is, I would argue today, much more a financial instrument than it is a trade instrument. It facilitates trade, but it is a major, it's the linchpin of the global financial system in a way that, you know, I think has come about, especially in the last 15 years, with the Bernanke yelling that cheap dollars. Hey, you know, it used to be that you'd borrow in yen and do carry trades. You'd borrow. Now people have used the dollar, which makes this situation, it makes me more cautious, where I would usually go right with, I'd be right with, I, no question about it. I just don't know now. And it keeps me, keeps me more guarded here until we see it. And you know, I wonder, are they going to have to do yield curve control to get, and that may facilitate that move in the debt markets, by the way, especially with duration. Although we look to Japan, how are they gonna get, you know, as people write about, how are they gonna get out of that yield curve control? Well, we saw the huge cost to Australia, and I would argue that Britain's pension issue, of course, we've seen some, I would almost, yeah, as David rightly calls it, you know, there's no more Fed, the Fed put is now a bond put. So yes, we're going to be in that world. I going forward to 2023 is fraught with all kinds of economic minefields, but the politics riding right with it is really making me nervous, because, and I think that, I honestly think this Fed doesn't take that enough into account. I think he unleashed the political demons yesterday quite a bit. And I think, if I'm wrong, won't be any big deal. But if I'm right, he's going to have a real problem going forward here, because they're going to become looking for him. You know, the two major players, from a Senate, or three majors, Sherrod Brown, Lizzie Warren, and of course, was Bernie Sanders.
Hickenlooper too wrote a letter.
Oh, Hickenlooper, right, who has more standing for those who are somewhat rational people. Although Sherrod Brown is certainly a high quality. Lizzie Warren, but I could tell Lizzie Warren wrote that letter. You could tell by, only a lawyer would footnote it the way that she footnoted it. So, or a lawyer of her standing. So, he's got some issues. And if unemployment, and if David's right, and unemployment jumps quickly, which I think it's going to do, by the way, I think unemployment is going to jack up faster than they think, then they're really, it's going to get really tough for him.
Well, great. Yeah, it's been a fascinating discussion. And what we'll do is we'll post the links to get more information on the blog, the blogs and the services that Peter and Dave has, and that post the blog post from Ira as well on the YouTube and also our website posting. And you can find more information there. So yeah, thank you very much, Peter, Dave, and Ira.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.